Chapter 12. The great hall filled early that evening. As a tribute to the king's advisers, the men and women of the court donned their finest clothes. A freshness in the air suggested most had washed themselves. Yet, unlike the evening before, when conversation flowed freely and raucous laughter circulated, on this night an unaccustomed silence hung like a pall over the entire room. For each and every noble gathered had felt the pinch that day from the new tax the king installed. Their pockets and purses, though still quite full, were freshly picked, and now a tad lighter, and this was a new experience for all. Their faces sported smiles and grins, but underneath they shared a common discontent. Despite this, when the royal trumpeters sounded the king's fanfare, all eyes turned to the hall's massive doors. These quickly swung apart, revealing the king, who, at that precise moment, was squirming in a vain attempt to readjust his bloomers. "Blasted shorts," muttered Darren as he fussed. "They're always riding up." Knowing not how best to react, the entire assemblage cheered and applauded. Flattered by the court's affection, Darren assumed a regal pose and marched into the room. When he reached the royal armchair behind the royal dais, he sat and very benignly raised his hand, the signal for everyone else to sit as well. There ensued a madcap scramble for seats, as many tried to sit close to the king. While dozens pushed and shoved and crammed together at tables nearer the dais, others sat contentedly or alone at tables farther away. "Please, please," said the impostor benevolently. "There is room for all." Once again the court applauded. But when the last person in the room had found a seat, and the king discovered the chair to his left and the two chairs to his right unoccupied, a dark and brooding look fell across his face. "Where is the Princess Mian?" asked the king. "And my two advisers? Where is the Duke of Cunningham or the Earl of Nightshade?" Pomp approached the dais in a regimented step, and, in a voice filled with his usual disdain, said,
"Your Grace, they are being placed in the vestibule at this very moment."
Darren gripped the arms of his chair. "Why were they not admitted before me?" Unruffled, Pomp replied,
"Sire, protocol demands your guests be received by you. Surely His Grace does not wish to break from years of ceremony and be greeted by the very men he wishes to honor." "No?"
Darren gazed at the expectant faces about him.
"No, no, no, certainly not," said the king, relinquishing.
"Very well, then, bring them in."
Pomp turned on his heels, a smug look upon his face, and, in the same regimented step, crossed to the opposite end of the room. He took his usual place by the door, smoothed a wrinkle in his robe, then rapped the floor with his long baton.
"With your Majesty's permission, the Duke of Cunningham and the Earl of Nightshade."
The trumpeters sounded another fanfare. All eyes turned as the doors swung open, revealing naught but an empty hallway. The king shifted in his seat. Seeing this, Pomp ignored the muttering of the crowd and quickly directed the court attendants to shut the doors. He cleared his throat to silence the hall and, resuming his staid expression, announced,
"With your Majesty's permission, the Duke of Cunningham and the Earl of Nightshade."
Once again, the trumpeters sounded their fanfare, and once again the doors were swung open, revealing an empty hallway.
"Well, Chamberlain,"
asked Darren with growing impatience,
"where are they?"
At the far end of the corridor extending from the room, just a few paces beyond the corner of the connecting hall, stood the gentleman in question. Cunningham paced back and forth, preoccupied. Nightshade rocked as usual.
"Whatever do you know?"
said the Earl frostily, breaking the silence.
I've heard them call our names twice already."
"I'm not deaf," said Cunningham without looking at the man. "Do you want to go in there without knowing if Mortimer succeeded? I, for one, do not." they had decided it was time for the king to meet his unexpected demise. The taxes they had collected amounted to what was probably the largest fortune anyone had ever amassed, and rather than turn it over to the king, they had decided to use the money to buy Cunningham's way to the throne. Nightshade's talents were employed once more. The king's chalice was painted with poison, a subtle mixture designed to leave everyone thinking he had died of natural causes. Since the beginning of the rainy season, minor bouts with boggy lung syndrome had turned up among members of the court. It was the perfect way to disguise an assassination. Nightshade was particularly proud of the concoction. After administering it to his servant, the man had died exactly as the Earl had predicted.
I've never designed a poison that could actually mimic an illness, but now, after doing so, it makes perfect sense.
So proud was he, the Earl had continued to gush about it while proceeding to the Great Hall.
You see, it will begin with a mild fever, and then a cough, and then heavy sputum that clogs the lungs. No one will think it was brought on by poison, and that's the beauty of it. Don't you see?
Enough, the Duke had said, sick of the man's tireless prattle. Who cares how it works just as long as it does? Aware of what the Duke was implying, Nightshade had taken offense at once.
What exactly do you mean by that?
Must I remind you, you failed at the joust?
Nightshade had grown used to the Duke's insults, but this he found particularly egregious and had stopped abruptly in his tracks.
Those circumstances were beyond my control. How was I to know Crushmore would grab the ceremonial cup and guzzle half the wine?
Cunningham had never been one to consider anyone else's feelings.
Trust you to bungle something when all our schemes hinge upon it.
Nightshade had brooded the rest of the way. Now, as they waited for Mortimer to arrive, there continued to be a strain between them.
I know not why you have brought this up, said the Earl flatly, with so much time having elapsed since the incident. But whatever the reason, you saw for yourself the poison was sufficient. It worked on Crushmore, did it not?
Keep your voice down, hissed Cunningham. Nightshade complied, but was unwilling to drop the subject.
I'm not a complete fool, you know.
I agree, said Cunningham, staring up and down the hall.
Is that an apology?
No, you are still a fool, just not completely. Nightshade bristled at this. There were times he regretted his association with the Duke. He was far too impressed with himself, especially since his reinstatement. Had it not been for Nightshade's money and talents, Cunningham would still be sleeping in run-down taverns and dodging irate bill collectors. The echo of footfalls reached their ears, and, after a beat, Mortimer appeared at the far corner of the passageway. Seeing the two lords, the henchman broke into a fast trot and came to a halt before them.
"What took you so long?" asked Cunningham irritably.
"I was double-checking my efforts."
Nightshade, still frustrated, turned his displeasure on the henchman.
"Well, was anything amiss?"
"Certainly not," said Mortimer, scowling. "When I do a job, it's done right."
The Earl saw this as another insult, but he knew the henchman was dangerous and a sort with whom one did not trifle.
"Please,"
said Nightshade with a forced smile.
"Won't you elaborate?"
"There's not much to say. After the mishap at the joust, I wanted to be thorough."
This was only partly true. In the early morning hours, Mortimer had stolen into the servants' quarters, slipped into the silver pantry, and coated the king's chalice. Later, however, to his consternation, when the time had come to set the tables, the chalice had been overlooked. Having no other option, it fell to Mortimer to deliver the cup, which was a challenge in itself, having been slathered with poison. But this had not bothered him half as much as the idea of being caught with the chalice in his possession. Employing all his skills as a trained assassin, he had slunk from shadow to shadow using corridors no longer favorable by the king or anyone else wanting to be seen for their stylishly expensive wardrobe. Reaching the banquet hall undetected, he had slipped into the gap between the rear wall and the banners hanging behind the dais.
There he had waited for hours, with sweat dripping down his face, peeking out from time to time until all the tables had been set and decorated. Eventually, the castle steward had called for the room to be vacated. Alone at last, Mortimer had slid from behind the banners and added the cup to the king's place setting. Afterwards, he had escaped through the bustling kitchen where, to his relief, no one had paid him any attention.
"Good," said Cunningham, and turning to Nightshade, the duke added, "Now remember, you must offer a toast."
"Why don't you do it?"
said the Earl acerbically. He was still upset from their exchange.
"You seem to be the man in charge."
"You act like it anyway."
Cunningham purposely ignored the remark. "It would look rather suspicious, don't you think? Especially since I don't drink."
The Earl thought on this a bit.
I suppose so."
But what am I supposed to say?"
The Duke was at the limit of his patience.
"Anything. Toast the kingdom."
No, wait a minute,"
protested Nightshade.
"In front of all those people, I think I should say something a little more eloquent than here's to the kingdom."
"What is the difference?" said Cunningham, seething. "Say whatever comes to mind, but keep toasting until the king drinks."
"You may say that."
"Nevertheless," said Nightshade resolute, I've an image to maintain. Now let me think."
And in his head he began to compose his oration. Pomp dropped to one knee with his hands clasped before him so tightly they were shaking.
"I don't understand the delay, Your Grace," said the Chamberlain in a most uncharacteristic manner. "This has never happened before. I know not what to say. I...
"Find them immediately," insisted the impostor, the muscles at his jaw bulging. "Search every inch of the palace, the entire city if you must. But find them and bring them to me." When it came to tax money, Darren had no sense of humor or trust. Sufficiently rebuked and humiliated, the Chamberlain scurried to the rear of the hall where two attendants, underlings he had always treated poorly, mocked him as they swung open the doors. To Pomp's considerable surprise, as well as everyone else's, there stood the Duke of Cunningham and the Earl of Nightshade waiting patiently to be announced.
"Gods be praised!" exclaimed Pomp. "I thought I'd lost you for good."
Ignoring their curious looks, the Chamberlain smoothed his hair, straightened his tunic, and turned back to the room.
"They're here!"
Darren felt his heart quicken with anticipation as the two nobles headed toward the dais.
"Ah, my lords, my friends," called the king buoyantly. "With this simple state function, we welcome you home again, after a long, tedious journey. Come, take your place at our side and share with us some food, some drink, some pleasant diversion, all to show our gratitude for your undertaking."
"I thank Your Grace for this tribute,"
said Cunningham in a voice that filled the hall.
"We are your humble servants."
"Then let us partake of this fare," said Darren, delighted, "and we shall discuss your journey afterwards."
Course after course was served, trays overflowing with honeyed pork roasted to perfection, peppered mutton marinated in brandywine, brown sugar yams on a bed of millet. Nightshade was in heaven and indulged himself in a second helping of everything. It took a jab of Cunningham's elbow to remind him of his purpose.
But,
blurted the Earl. He tried to stand without taking his seat with him. After two more attempts, the steward behind him held fast to the chair, allowing Nightshade to rise unimpeded. By now, all eyes in the room were upon him, and realizing this, the Earl suddenly felt conspicuous. Every word he had prepared vanished from his head.
I wish to thank His Majesty for the honor he has bestowed upon us. How about a toast?"
And without waiting for the king's permission, he swept up his goblet and raised it high.
"Here's to the kingdom!"
"The kingdom!"
The hall resounded, and goblets were raised in salute.
"Oh, I don't know if that's enough. No. Better get him to drink the whole glass," thought the man,
just in case the film has evaporated somewhat.
"Here's to the Lady Mian!"
"Mian," the hall responded, and everyone drank.
"To the Queen Mother!"
"The Queen Mother!"
"To tonight! Isn't it a lovely evening?"
"A lovely evening!"
Nightshade watched the king drain the last of his cup. Then, satisfied, he took his seat and wiped his brow, deliberately ignoring Cunningham's scornful expression.
"Now, boys, it's past your bedtime. Go home to your mother," said Cleve, placing Cower comfortably before the block.
"Ah, Dad, can't we stay?"
whined the gnome.
"We want to see how far his blood spurts. Last guy came nowhere near breaking the record."
"I said go home to your mother," stated Cleve, harsher than he had wanted. Angry, the gnome kicked the dirt and pouted. But Gnome obeyed and, grabbing his brother by the arm, led him out of the small courtyard. Cleve followed them a few paces to make certain they had left, as very often they would double back to watch the beheadings.
"I'm sorry about that," said the executioner, returning to the block. "Sometimes they're a bit rambunctious."
"Think nothing of it," replied Cower.
"They're nice kids. You should be proud of them."
"Ha, I am," said Cleve with fatherly pride.
"I'm hoping they'll follow in me footsteps some day. You know, start a family tradition."
He grabbed his axe, hefted it a few times, then took a practice swing.
"All right, Master Cower, if you'll place your head down, please."
"Like so," said Cower, complying.
"Yes, that's good. You might want to turn your collar down. You could grab the blade and keep it from slicing through cleanly."
"Of course, we wouldn't want sloppy."
He adjusted his collar, then rested his head upon the polished wood.
"Nice grain,"
thought the retainer.
"Bird's eye maple, I think."
And this surprised him. By now he had expected to be overcome with fear, but instead a strange peace had settled over him. Images from his past were surfacing with stunning clarity.
"So, this is how the gods prepare a man for death," marveled Cower. "By distracting him. Bless me if it isn't that little peasant girl I knew as a lad. My, she was pretty. That is, until she contracted the plague. I wonder if I'll be seeing her again. I don't suppose one can catch the plague after one is dead."
The executioner raised his axe. Higher, higher still, until it was at the peak of its arc. He took a long, slow breath to support his swing, but then he paused, releasing the air from his lungs. To his own surprise, he lowered the axe. It took him a moment to collect his thoughts, for he had not often used his mind to consider weighty things. According to Master Cower, the prince was the king, and the king was the prince. And if that was true, then the world was upside down. And if the world was upside down, then it also stood to reason right was wrong. And if such was the case, where stood Master Cower?
"Could you please hurry things up a bit?" asked the retainer politely. "My life has been flashing before me, and I'm getting pretty close to the present."
Cleve was sweating, and for the first time in his career, his hands shook.
"But wait," he thought. "What does it matter if the world is upside down? What does it matter if the king is an impostor? If everyone thinks he's the king, he can do exactly as he pleases. If I disobey his wishes, I'll find myself in Master Cower's position."
He thought on this a moment. Were it just him, he could accept the consequences. But there was Malady to think about. She was not a healthy woman and growing sicker by the day. This reminded him of something else. Had it not been for the retainer and his potions, she would have already passed away. His hood felt suffocating, and he tore it from his head. He looked at Cower, so fragile, so timid. How could such a man be a threat to the king?
"Stand up, Master Cower," said Cleve, offering him his hand. "I'll not be taking your life today."
The retainer eyed him dubiously.
"Really?"
Cleve nodded.
"Aye, really."
"This isn't your attempt at executioner humour, is it?"
"No,"
replied Cleve with a slight grin, and helping the retainer to his feet, he added,
"This time I'll just have to take the loss."
But then he sobered.
"Master Cower, do you think the king, I mean the prince, whoever's down there in the dungeon would help me and me family?"
"I'm sure of it,"
replied Cower, encouraged. Cleve nodded thoughtfully.
"Then I suggest we act quickly."
They made their plans and parted ways, Cower for the castle kitchen and Cleve for home to prepare Malady and the boys. But when he told his wife what he had done, she immediately grew irate.
"You let him go? How could you do such a foolish thing?"
"'Cause I owed him something more than lopping off his head," explained Cleve, controlling his temper.
She burst into tears and made a gurgling sound, the same as she always made when phlegm collected in her throat. Cleve, however, was unaware
unalarmed. Turning his wife around, the executioner whacked her squarely between her shoulder blades. This seemed to help almost at once, as her coughing suddenly abated.
"Look," said the man firmly, turning her to him. "He saved your life. If it wasn't for Master Coward's kindness, you wouldn't be here right now."
She gazed at him, her nose dripping.
"I understand that, but there's things what come before gratitude. Cash, for instance. I suppose you even returned his tip."
"He never gave me one."
"Oh!"
exclaimed the woman, exasperated and clutching her breasts.
"We've kids to feed, you know, and these dried up years ago."
Suddenly a new thought struck her. She hurried to the threshold of their hovel, opened the door a crack, and peered down the street.
"Supposing the king finds out, what will happen to us then?"
Cleve glanced at the floor sheepishly.
"Well, speaking of the king, there's something else you should know."
Malady closed the door and faced him.
"What have you done?"
His head began to ache again. The information Master Cower had confided in him was more complex than anything he had ever considered. It was confusing, unsettling, and made his stomach churn. Yet he could not dismiss it. He tried his best to explain to Malady exactly what he had learned. A sick look, one different from the norm, came over the woman's face.
"So if the king's not the king, then who is he?"
"The prince."
"The king's the prince?"
"Aye."
"You've lost me."
"That's what I said."
With so much coming at her at once, Malady flew into a rage.
"Of all the addlepated, what's gotten into you, Cleve? You've gone and ruined us."
"Have you heard nothing?"
shouted the man. She stared at him in shock. This was the first time he had ever raised his voice to her.
"There's things what come up sometimes that are more important than just getting by, and this is one of them. Now wake the kids and stop pecking while I scare up a wagon."
"All right," said his wife contritely, "but you don't have to snap."
He looked at her, and his expression softened.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Puddin'."
He went and put his arms around her.
"I should have consulted with you first."
He ran his hand over her hair, noting how grey and dull it was.
"Is that another bald spot?" thought the executioner.
Anguished, he pressed her face tightly against his chest.
"But what's done is done. We've always wanted to get away from here and have that cottage of our own. Well, now is our chance. The prince will reward us, you'll see. And then you and the kids can have that life you deserve. What do you say, Puddin'? Are you with me on this one?"
"I love,"
came her smothered reply.
"Now, if you don't mind, I could deal with a bit of air.